Welcome to Defining Roles, a podcast about jobs you may have never heard of. I'm your host, Kate Barrett. Let's explore the possibilities of what's out there so that we can find our perfect role. Oh my goodness, it feels so good to be back in front of the mic with you. I took a nice long break in December to recharge. And then January, I just jumped in fully into my job search because I'm still on that journey looking for my perfect role. And now I'm back to do more interviews. And this week, I'm very excited to share with you the interview that I did with Kelsey Hodges, who is a rocket scientist, officially a staff engineer for a contracting company that works with NASA. And Kelsey was so kind to sit down and share with us all about her job. And I bet you'll feel a little bit smarter after this conversation, just understanding her world and a look inside of an industry that I didn't know very much about. Before we get into the interview, I do want to mention that the audio quality on this one is not quite as sharp as usual. I trust that you'll be forgiving. You get to see my work in progress as I learn, and not quite sure what happened, if it was a bad connection or whatever it was, but I've just been learning in a few areas of my life that perfectionism often gets in the way. And so this was just a big test of, you know, I could work with it until it's perfect, or I can just share it and know that you'll hear the beautiful interview that, you know, it's just not quite as dialed as normal. But I am so excited to share this one with you. Kelsey is so lovely. You're going to love her. One more thing before we jump into this week's interview. I am going to releasing 2 episodes per month instead of doing one every week. It will just make things a little more manageable. And being that this is not my full-time gig, it will just allow me more space and time to right now work on finding a job and then have a job. And twice a month, we'll still get some great interviews out there. It will just be more manageable. Okay, now to the interview with our rocket scientist. Kelsey, I am so excited to jump into our conversation. Thank you so much for joining me today.
I am so excited to be here. I've been looking forward to it all week.
Let's start with, what is your official job title?
Okay. So my official job title is a staff engineer for Dynamic Concepts, Inc., which is a specialty subcontractor on the NASA Space Launch System program, which is building the rocket that is going to take us to the moon and to Mars and basically launch anything super heavy that we need to up into space. So
awesome. How would you define your role?
So I work for a company that specializes in dynamic analysis. And so what our job is, we're brought on to the SLS contract from the NASA side, and we basically look at any of the forces on the rocket while it's moving. So that could be, like, I have teammates who do the forces during liftoff, which are like lighting the engines, lighting the boosters, the air as as the rocket ascends and moves up through the air. Or my team is pre-launch. And so there, like, we're going to have this rocket sitting out on the pad for maybe 6 months, right? Sometimes it's hard to find a window when you're going to launch the rocket. And so what I have been working on is the team assessing ground wind loads on the rocket. So if it's sitting out there on the pad, or you're rolling out to the pad, right? And there's like, it's Florida. So there could be, you know, a huge, like a very large wind. And so we're just assessing that and saying, okay, does that hurt anything? Like, are all of these loads something that we can take? is this going to result in any, you know, snapped bolts, things that would make a flight a very bad day. So that's sort of, that's like what the team that I'm on does. And then my role within that is a lot of running models and simulation.
Awesome. So all of the factors as it's sitting on the launch pad that could shift or change or create any sort of impact onto the structure is what you're working on.
Exactly. So there's like, there's a couple different, if you're building something like a rocket, you want it to be really light. Because basically any, like the biggest constraining factor when you're launching something into space is how much things weigh. And you want to launch the largest, heaviest thing you can think of, because that's how you get it to be as cheap as you can. But to do that, you need like a really lightweight structure for the rocket, right? Like you want to allocate as much mass as you can to the interesting stuff sitting on top of the rocket. So the rocket itself is really light, which means that unlike, you know, if we're building a bridge, just throw some more concrete on it, right? Like we can make that thing really strong. But for a rocket, like we need it to be as light as possible. And so we're interested in making sure that the rocket that we've designed is strong enough to withstand all the possible loads that might happen to it. And there's two teams that do that. There's one team that does like static, which is anything that's still, basically. So say like if the rocket is sitting on the pad and you put a bunch of heavy fuel into the rocket, all of the load on the lower part of the rocket that's supporting that fuel is static because that's not changing at all. And so my team, because it's dynamic analysis, we're not actually worried about the static portions at all. We're worried about things that come from moving forces. And so that's like the moving, like the wind. We put it on this big, a truck is not quite the right word, but sort of like a caterpillar, and we roll it out to the pad. And so we're worried about that. And then when you actually turn on rocket engines or the booster engines, that the thrust that's being applied changes a lot, like over the course of their lifespan. And so that's dynamic input as well. So that's sort of how I think about it.
So those could all shift. Is it the parts and then that's what you're worried about, things coming off or structures not moving? So what is the significance and why is what you do so important and to then like the launch and to what comes after?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So what we do is, since I'm a contractor on the NASA side, we're responsible for the big like primary structure loads. And so what that is we're, the rocket is a bunch of different elements that are made by different companies. And so we have like a core stage that's made by Boeing, and we have boosters that are made by Aerojet Rocketdyne. We have a crew capsule that's made by Lockheed. And so what our job is as the loads team is to assess all of these different events. And then we provide we provide NASA, who provides these companies that are building all the different pieces of the rocket, provide them with the loads that we've calculated. And so they can then take those loads and say, yes, we have designed to this or to something higher than this. And so we've built a rocket that will not fall apart during this time. or they take the loads that we built and they say, okay, no, like we have a problem. If you say this, then like we think that the engine's going to shake itself apart, right? Or we know okay. that this valve can only withstand like this many pounds. And you're saying that we're going to see, you know, 30% more than that. And that's like the other part of what I end up doing is then you work with the elements, like the different companies that are actually building the parts of the rocket. And you say, okay, did we overestimate the load? Like, is this something where we can make a lower estimate and say, okay, no, we actually think that you won't see that much? Or is this something where we say, no, like this is as close as we can get. Like, we think that you might have a problem.
So when you say load, are you referring to the ship and like, you know, when a truck has a load that it's carrying, is that how you're using the term?
Oh, that's also a great question as I just slip into using these words. When I say load, I'm mostly talking about like forces and moments that are being applied on the rocket. So if you were to take like your pen and you were to move it back and forth, like in your hand, the load that you're applying, you would be applying a load to that pen with your finger. So it's basically like any force that you're applying on the vehicle. But because we can also apply moments, which are just forces, but they're applied like sort of from a distance, then we use like a generic term. It's called load, basically.
Okay. This is where we all just keep moving because it all makes sense and we are talking to a rocket scientist. You mentioned a little bit about the structure of the industry. And so when we all think of space, we think of NASA, and you mentioned that you work for a contractor. So just a brief little outline that you kind of provided. NASA is more like the coordinator of all of these space programs, and then there's the contractors that build the parts or create the programs for analysis and have all of kind of the moving pieces. Is that an accurate bird's eye view of the industry?
Yeah, that's like it's interesting because, you know, a lot of people they think of NASA as like building things, and they do build some things. Like they build rovers, and for the SLS at least they do oversight. And so I still work from the NASA side of this program. But yeah, exactly. I'm contracted out. So I'm doing this analysis for NASA. And then they take those pieces and they distribute it to the people who are building things. So, awesome. So it's a cool way to get a lot more people involved in NASA programs than just the people who work at NASA.
Right. And then another term, SLS.
Yeah. That's the Space Launch System. So that is the official name of the rocket that I work on.
Kelsey, would you quickly take us through your educational background and how you learned everything you need to learn to work on these sophisticated programs?
Yeah, absolutely. So my bachelor's is in aeronautics and astronautics from the University of Washington. And I was pretty lucky going in to college because I at one point wanted to be an astronaut. I had really bad eyesight. And so there was a point in the 90s when that was disqualifying for an astronaut, which 11-year-old me was very sad about. But high school me, it worked out fine because I was like, well, this is related. I'll be an engineer. I like math and science. This sounds reasonable. And so I chose University of Washington specifically for the Aero Astro program. And it was, wow. It was in state, you know, which is always a bonus. And then when I graduated, I moved down to Huntsville to start work with Boeing on SLS. And then a year into working with Boeing I started getting my master's in mechanical engineering online from Georgia Tech through their education work program. So currently I have a bachelor's in aeronautics and astronautics, a master's in mechanical engineering. And I think that's it. I think I'm done.
Yeah. Well, you had mentioned when we were talking earlier that for most of what you do and for many people that go into astronautics and
aeronautics.
Aeronautics.
Yeah, thank you. It's all the same. You can say like aero-astro. Yeah. That's what all the kids
okay.
call it.
Yeah. Those that go into aero-astro, yep. An undergrad degree is really all that you need?
Yeah. So it's interesting, especially for a lot of the engineering jobs that are out in industry. There are some exceptions, like where I currently work is a lot more academically focused. So I work with a lot of doctorates. And most of the people I work with have a master's, I think. But it's pretty standard for your, you know, entry level engineer to come in with just a bachelor's. And I think that a big part of that is that once you start moving towards engineering graduate school, especially, you start getting a lot more academically focused, which is good, but you've already got the fundamentals, right? You've got like the physics fundamentals and the stress and all of that. And so you start moving away from things that are used out in industry. So it's different whether you're, you know, trying in a lab to predict, you know, all of the ways that this plate might move under this motion versus if you're on a development program and you're just trying to tell the propulsion guys whether or not this line is going to break and you're trying to do it fast, you know? And so at least what I have seen working on SLS is just that most of the things that I do, like it's necessary to have that fundamentals background. Like you need to know the physics. I took a class on vibrations, which sounds really funny, but like, you know, just the mathematical underpinnings of that are important. But once you get that, most of your training, like the experience that's actually helpful when you're doing your job comes from, like, you know, most other jobs comes from being on the job.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of these companies have found that, you know, rather than depend on undergrad or graduate degrees to, you know, walk these, like the students through the way that they want these problems solved, they say, look, teach them the basics and then we'll take them.
That's so cool to hear that, like, the fundamentals and these equations don't change. And they can be, you know, physics is physics and engineering basics. Once you learn those, they can be applied to the programs that you're working on. And also the technologies are advancing so quickly that by the time the schools kind of catch up, it's already changed.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And it's like there's also a lot of decisions that get made on these programs that are, you know, we use the term engineering judgment a lot, right? Like you don't have, a lot of times you don't have an answer. You're not going to have an answer until you launch something. And so you have to just say, okay, you know what? I spent enough time on this. This is a good enough guess. Mm-hmm. And that is obviously not always the approach that you want to take to like your homework.
Yeah. Right. What is your day-to-day look like? What do you work on? And yeah. How is your team structured?
So my team is very small. It's, and part of the reason why I really like working where I do is that it's small and it's focused a lot on analysis. We're all running simulations and running models and doing this. And it's fun for me because I am a complete nerd at heart, but day to day for a small team, I would say my time is probably split. The majority of it is probably running different, or creating models and creating different simulations and running them. We have a lot of heritage codes, which just means like codes that have been with the company for a long time. A lot of the guys I worked on Shuttle, you know, and they worked on all these programs that happened before SLS did. And so we have a lot of codes that we can use for this. And so probably most of my time is spent updating inputs to those to reflect, you know, what the program looks like now, running them, monitoring them, and trying to like check the outputs. And all of that stuff is done in MATLAB. So that's about 50-50, you know, like engineering, like we're looking at the math and we're looking at it all, and about the other half is, you know, coding. Like, can I make this for loop run so that the script doesn't break every time I try to, you know, run more than 3,000 lines or something? So that's like, that was, if, you know, if you were asking me what my job is, that's what I tell you, right? So I'm running the model simulations, doing all of this. But there's also, you know, as with any job, right? Like you have your top line and then you have the other stuff that you end up doing. And so I'd say probably, you know, there's another like 40% of my days on average where about half of it is presenting this information and not like, you know, showing it to people actively all the time, but making sure that it's, you know, making the charts, trying to plot something so that it makes sense and it, you can look at it and understand what's happening. Trying to, you know, make charts that explain what we did and that won't get us in trouble down the line.
Right.
And like, you know, just, and I think that that's something that is a little bit undervalued in engineering, just because there is so much of a focus on like technical skills that I think that like being able to know how to present information and large amounts of data in like a cogent way is really important. And yeah, just underrated. So I do spend a decent amount of my time doing that. And then the other, you know, whatever is left is spent on like tool development, which is just more of the coding, like working with the sims, but it's usually more from scratch. And I do all of that in MATLAB, which is like the engineering programming language. Basically it's like the dumbest possible version of programming, but it also is super powerful for different math functions basically. So awesome. Yeah, it's,
so when you talk about the charts and having to communicate all of your findings and these simulations that you create, that's because they're being passed on to companies like Boeing or to other parties that then use other contractors that are using what you find and what you come up with, correct?
Yeah, yeah. So it's actually probably – so at – in the end, that's what happens to it. And that's like, that is really why we're, you know, making sure that we can go through and present what we're actually seeing. There's also typically before we pass these results on, we go through like technical review boards. And so that's basically, you have engineers who are higher up, who are, you know, really good, really strong technically. And so you, or just like big groups of people from the elements who like really know their stuff, and you have to present to them basically before you can release anything. And so most of the time that I spend, trying to, you know, prepare this stuff for presentation is for those like review boards, because they're the ones who look over and are going to ask you like the really tough, like hitting questions. Right. And like, right. Or to be like, you know, if you put something up there, be like, I don't think that looks right. And you got to be able to answer it.
Well, and that's the important part to do that. Cause we were talking earlier too, about the importance of accuracy and measurements and what can go wrong if you are even a little bit off. And so having those checks and balances and system in place just to make sure everyone is on their game, it's really important.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And like, it's so funny because, you know, I was saying earlier, right? Like we don't, it's not like homework, like you don't have the answer, but you do still sort of get graded, which is good, right? It's like you're saying, like, I think it was in the 90s, but there was a Mars rover that crashed into the surface of Mars because Lockheed used one set of units, like they used imperial units, and NASA was using metric units, and right. That just never got communicated. Like no one caught it, no one did, and you know, if you're in the wrong units, like you're gonna make the rover's gonna make bad decisions about when it should stop and, you know, how fast it thinks it's going. So yeah, exactly. Like you're saying, it's really good. I think that's something that I wasn't really expecting coming into like the professional world was I feel like you get told a lot, especially in undergrad engineering, you get told a lot that like, you know, you're going to have to get this right when you go through, like, this is, you know, these are all the things you're going to have to know. If you make, you know, bad decisions on this, then you're going to have a rover incident. You're going to have like something yeah. like this. And
nobody wants that.
Exactly.
On
oh God. Exactly. The most embarrassing, but it is good. Like obviously these checks don't catch everything, you know, but there really is a system in place of like how, you know, to have different people review these things. And so that hopefully makes everybody feel a little bit better about their engineering.
Yeah. Right. And it's kind of, how do we learn from the mistakes that have been made? Usually there's ways to go back and trace what happened. And when it is simply someone was using different measurements instead of the universal metric system that the rest of the world uses, we were using, you know, like Americans are the only country that uses feet and pounds and our English measurements. That's what happened, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was the Mars incident.
Yeah.
Instead of metrics. And so then it's this, let's make sure everybody is on the same page because that is so avoidable.
Yeah. That's exactly, it's like, and I think of this, like, it's funny because obviously these companies are doing this at a large scale, right? Like they're saying, okay, look, here's this mistake we made. It's avoidable. Let's make sure we avoid it next time. But you're also sort of doing that individually as you move through, like, you know, my job. I have a bunch of issues that I have run into with simulations. You know, I have various Excel spreadsheets in places where I say, okay, I'm never making this mistake again. Yeah. You know, you keep it that you're like, I ran a whole set of models and I didn't change this. And you have your little checklist that you go through every time. It's like, I mean, that's what I try to tell new hires who come through, right? Like at some point you're just trying to find as many mistakes as you can so that you don't make them next time.
How do you not feel defeated when that is your model of like every day is I can't make a mistake?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it is that like if you work with, you know, thankfully the type of teams that I work with and, you know, on this program, like you realize how much we just don't know, right? Like engineering is literally just make your best guess. You know, science is like, we're trying to move closer to the right answer. And engineering is sort of like that. But a lot of it is just like, get as close to the answer as you can until, okay, no, we can't do this anymore. We're taking a guess. And so for when you're in that type of mindset, you know, when you know that like, you're gonna be wrong and you're gonna miss things, then it becomes a lot easier when you are wrong and you do miss things, you know, to be like, okay, great. Like now we know, you know, yeah. Because it is like, it is pretty frequent. Like there's a lot of things that you're encountering all the time. And it does, I think it's easier with like the development programs too, you know, like I think if I were working like on the Boeing, like commercial airplane side, which is just such an established business. They really have the engineering that they do there, like down pat, you know. I think that it would probably be different. Like the pressure on making mistakes would be different. But because this is the first time anyone's done a lot of this stuff, it's like you try to learn from past programs and then you're sort of out there blazing a trail. But it does definitely toggle between being a little stressful. Yeah. But it's also, I mean, it's invigorating. It's sort of fun. You know, you get to like steer your own path, and it's really rewarding when you're, I mean, we haven't flown anything, so we haven't been able to prove that it's right yet, but
yeah,
you know, you can also, if you take it to a bunch of the experts and they say, yeah, I think that, you know, looks like you did a good job, then that's something. Take it.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That must feel amazing.
Yeah. Right.
What are some of the hard versus soft skills that you use? We just covered a bunch of them, like the programs, that you're running all of your simulations through and the engineering. But if you would just kind of summarize some of the technical training hard skills versus those soft skills that you're innately good at.
Yeah. Yeah. So the technical stuff is, yeah, like you said, like there's being comfortable with the programming aspect. So I use MATLAB. I know, I think NASA has been shifting to Python. And that's all just, yeah, how much do you code? How comfortable are you with it? A lot of the, you know, we've talked about the knowing and understanding the physics underpinnings. And a lot of that, like, obviously it's, you know, I don't think I would recommend this job to anyone who hadn't taken a physics class, but it's also something where you get better at it as you get more familiar with it. You know, like there's a significant relationship the natural frequency of, you know, anything that we're analyzing is dependent on the mass and the stiffness. And the only way that I can tell you, you know, if the stiffness goes up, the frequency goes up, is because it's because I understand the physics, but mostly it's just because I've been doing this enough that it's like sort of burned into my brain. You know, it just comes from that like on the job experience. So I think those are probably like, technically it's the biggest. It's like, can you find your way in coding enough to like manipulate the data and make the sims do what you want? And then do you understand the physics enough that you can understand if your simulation makes sense, you know, and if your model makes sense. But for the soft skills, that's like, I think what I have also been sort of surprised by, you know, being in industry for 6 years is because, you know, we have the stereotype of like the super awkward engineer, right? Who like goes off, sits with their computer and just like doesn't really talk to anyone, and they don't have to because they're brilliant and it doesn't matter. And sort of like we were talking about earlier, I mean, maybe there are people who can get away with that, you know, I'm sure that there are, but at least in, you know, I don't have the technical skills to be able to like bank on not explaining to anyone what I did or how I thought about a problem. And so I really think that it's important both to be able to communicate, you know, something verbally, but also to be able to, you know, create like written records of what you did, you know, they're like create plots that make sense and that are useful, and to really be able to tell like, a story in, you know, I'm a big PowerPoint fan, and like, yeah. To be able to like have a set of charts that someone can look at and understand what assumptions you made, and you know, take a look at the data that, you know, that came out of this analysis and feel confident that it's right. It's just like a huge, like I see so many really, really skilled analysts who have a hard time, you know, who just like don't see it as a focus, which is understandable, right? Like you think you're there to do math and you're there to run the sims, but then it makes for like a lot of very miserable reviews if you can't, you know, support your data, or if you have like, you know, like poorly made charts or things that people have a hard time understanding. And maybe that's, you know, something they're willing to deal with, but it stresses me out. So I think that's something that's like, it's really valuable.
Yeah. Just that clear communication so they get it. You spend less time explaining it later.
Exactly. Right. It saves so much time and stress. Like I'm not standing up in front of someone just sweating profusely like questioning me. So yeah. And then I think like the other biggest one, which is something that I actually wasn't, I wouldn't have said that I was particularly good at before I started this job, but have sort of had to get good at and have really like seen it pay dividends, is just like organization. You know, like, cause especially once, you know, you've been working for a couple years, like you're gonna run into some of the same problems And so a lot of how miserable that's going to make you is determined by like whether or not you remember what you did the last time you ran into that problem, you know?
Yeah. So I'm hearing a very important skill is patience.
Yeah.
Right. Patience with the process and just like just very systematic.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's like that. And I do think that, you know, there are people who are more inclined towards like the systematic thinking. And I definitely am. Like, I love my routines. I like, you know, I grew up eating the same thing for lunch for like years at a time. Like, I have the same thing for breakfast every morning. And like, wow. So I do, you know, like people are like, I think there are people who have proclivities for this, but it's also something that I like have really had to work on. Like, it's really tempting. Like, there's a lot of times when you're tired of something. You've been working on it for so long. You just want it to stop. And it's just, it always rewards you if you just take the extra time, like to just check it again.
Yeah. What are your thoughts and how do you feel when people use the phrase, it's not rocket science?
So I'm always conflicted. To be clear, I love that phrase. I have it printed on lots of things. I enjoy it. But it's also funny because I think, and I don't know, I'm sure this is, you know, true for anyone. It's like when you're in a job and you're working on the nitty gritty, you know, like we just talked about, there's some technical skills that people need and there's, you know, soft skills that make you better at the job. But I'm always just like, I don't know. I think like, I do think a lot of people could do this. Like, it's hard. It's, you know, the project itself is really hard and scary, but like, I love what I'm doing. I think I'm really lucky to do it, but I never feel like it's like, you know, something really hard that like only a few select people can do. So it's always funny to me to hear that it's not rocket science.
Yeah.
Cause like, I love the sentiment, but I'm always like, I don't know. I don't know that I feel like I do rocket science either. I just do math sometimes, you guys.
Yeah. What is it that's so misunderstood or that, where do you think that concept comes from? Is this is like only the select few can do it?
Well, I do think that like, I mean, I can get on my soapbox, but I think that math and science proclivity is something that like we just get told from a really early age that like you either have it or you don't, you know? And I think that is true to some extent. Like, I do really think that there's some people whose brains just like process things better. Like, I've always been like a problem solver. Like, if, you know, I crushed standardized tests because all you're doing is solving a bunch of little tiny problems, right? That's like how my brain is set up. And I know that there's a lot of people whose like brains aren't set up like that. But I really do think that, you know, there's also a lot of stuff that like doesn't come easily to me. Like, physics has never really come that easily to me. Like, it's something that I feel like I've like had to work at a lot to like really get like a passable mastery of.
Yeah.
And so I think that like, I think part of the, you know, rocket science thing just comes from the fact that like rocket science is super impressive. Right. And it is, I mean, it is hard, but it's also like, it's a hard project that's made easier by like a lot of people just doing like their small piece of it, you know? And I think that there's a lot of people who have grown up thinking that, oh, I'm not good at math because I, you know, didn't understand it when in eighth grade. Right. And I like, and, but my friend did. And so I'm not cut out for it. I'll do something else. And like, I think, you know, there's some truth in that, but I also think that there are a lot of people who would have benefited from, again, just like not patience on their part. Like, it's not the, you know, it's not the kid's fault, but like who would have benefited from like seeing that, oh, I don't know, maybe, you know, we spend a little more time on this, right? Or maybe if I can get a teacher who can explain it in a different way, then like this is something that I can do. So I don't know. I think that's how I'm always just like, you know, I love doing it. It is hard sometimes, but that, there's plenty of things that are hard sometimes.
And it sounds like you mentioned earlier that you knew from a young age that you wanted to get into, you mentioned being an astronaut when you were a kid and then tweaked once you realized that there may be some limiting factors that you just tweaked the vision. You didn't have to abandon the whole vision. So it sounds like that's just kind of part of your personality of this is something I want to do. I'm going to find a way, even if I have to work a little harder.
Yeah. And I mean, I do think that like I've been, you know, something that does make a lot of this stuff easy when you're working hard is if you're like, yeah, I'm interested in it, right? Like I have, you know, my husband also works for an aerospace company, and he loves what he does, but he doesn't have that drive, like that obsession with space sort of that I do. And like, you know, it still works, but it's like very different motivations.
That's interesting. Yeah. It's for him, it's more of like technical skills that he's good at versus you. It's like anything that's in this that deals with space you're interested in.
Yeah, exactly. Which like gives me a lot of leeway in, you know, what I actually end up doing on some level, and on some level it doesn't. Like I think when I was at Boeing, I worked on a missile program for probably about a year, and I was really shocked at how much I just wasn't interested in the work I was doing. It was very similar to what I was doing for the Space Launch System, but I was just like, you know, it's not rockets. This like takes a lot of the fun out of it for me.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
The technical skills you're using are the same. You just know the end use is different.
Exactly. And it's like, I don't know that I would have called that it was fine, but yeah, I was just like, man, I guess this is good. I learned something about myself today.
Yeah. Final question for you. I could keep going with so many different questions, but what is the best piece of career advice you have either received or would offer to others?
Oh man. Okay. I think that this is both, because this is sort of something that I have been told a lot, and then that I've also just like recently really embraced and have been seeing dividends from. But like, truly do not be afraid to ask questions. I feel like especially in engineering, there are so many people around who know so much, and a lot of the value of what they know is just from like pure experience, right? It's not in like textbooks, it's not getting bitten up somewhere. And so there's one, a lot of knowledge that's like, you know, locked up in your coworkers, basically, like that you can, you know, gain just by asking them about it. But also I have a tendency to just assume if someone's authoritative that they know more than me, and to also therefore assume that this reflects poorly on me and that I should really try to like figure it out on myself, like on my own, so that I can, you know, make sure I'm living up to the same level of knowledge that this person is so obviously displaying. And what I've found with a lot of that is that like some people are just a lot better at like acting confident in their decisions, you know? And so you lose absolutely nothing by just asking questions, right? Just being like, you know, and sometimes you'll find out that they really don't know that much more than you. Or like, you know, maybe they do. And then now you know that too, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's been my like, is it's perfectly acceptable to not know something, and you can get that fixed a lot faster by asking someone rather than like, you know, running to try to vertically like Google it and figure it out for yourself.
Save yourself a little bit of energy.
Exactly. Right. And also, I mean, people love it. Like, people really do enjoy like explaining things to you, right? Like as a general rule. So it's, yeah, it's easier for everyone.
Absolutely. Kelsey, thank you so much for your time today and sharing a little bit about this industry that does seem so far out there, but really comes down to systems and programs. And in your case, that mystery and passion for space.
Thank you so much for having me.
How cool is Kelsey? That was so wonderful. Thank you again to Kelsey for all of your time and for sharing about your world and helping us understand a little bit about the industry as a whole and your role within the larger industry. I love the point that Kelsey made about that rocket science, yes, it is a big, complicated tasks that they are going after, but it's made possible by the small individual role that each person plays. And so breaking it down makes it more attainable. And that really stuck with me of, oh yeah, big problems, you know, if you break them down and you just focus on one thing, they are way more manageable. So Kelsey, you make me want to be better at math. Thank you. Not that it's going to happen, but I feel a little more empowered. Thank you so much for tuning in again this week. I am so delighted to be back, and I have some great interviews planned coming up as well moving forward. Jump over to Instagram if you'd like to get connected and see a little bit of the behind the scenes and things that I do over there. Send me an email, send me a DM. You have no idea how meaningful it is when I get feedback and hear from people that are actually listening. It truly means a lot to me. I hope you're doing well. I will catch you next time on another episode of Defining Roles.